So one of the things well known about mindfulness practice, Buddhist meditation practice in general, is that it's very much based on being present in the present moment. It's a practice that aims to bring us into the present moment more fully, and then to but not just to be present for its own sake, which sometimes is quite lovely and profound, but to begin utilizing or engaging some of the potential that comes when we can be present for our experience. And some of the potential of mindfulness practice that can be actualized when we're present, when we're in the now, is really something that belongs to the world of time, that the benefits come in the future, that the benefits we're putting in place, we're doing the activities, we're doing the meditation practice in such a way that benefits will come sometimes well into the future. And so what are those benefits? What's part of the long game of meditation that that we're engaged in here and now? So I'll start with an analogy of raising children. And so I had the experience, so I think probably plenty of parents have, of when the kids are quite young, 2, 3, sometimes even 4, 5, maybe even older sometimes, that we might do a lot of effort to do something wonderful with the children and take them to some wonderful place, do some kind of wonderful activity at home, spend a lot of time to really do something quite marvelous. And as the kids grow older, they don't remember. So many of the things and what parents can remember were special moments. The kids weren't particularly special for the kids. They don't remember. So the event, the activity, that the experience, the conscious experience of something doesn't remain for the children in the way sometimes for parents they do. But what remains is a few things. One is early childhood, things that the kids don't remember, is that they're receiving the conditions. They're being conditioned, they're being influenced or nourished, supported, impacted by the environment that they're in. So if the parents are, or the family or the environment, is creating an environment where the kids feel safe, nurtured, loved, cared for, that creates a very different conditioning for the child than if the child grows up with violence and anger and being ignored and being dismissed and all kinds of things. And very different conditioning. If they feel safe and cared for, something can relax and they feel at home in the world. They feel comfortable. But if there's war and violence and anger and drunkenness and, you know, chaos and dismissing and ignoring, then they don't feel like they belong. They feel like something's wrong. They feel they have to protect themselves. They feel tense. They feel afraid. And that each of those two scenarios creates a very different conditioning. And that conditioning can last well into a person's whole life. They don't remember all the details, but the conditioning has remained. And some people feel like even before kids learn language and have the words to remember what happened, they're already being conditioned by the environment in that first year of their life in a very deep way. So one of the ways that meditation or Buddhist practice works, a very important part of it, is that we are putting in place conditions that that condition us in a good way, that influence us on this, maybe even this subliminal or a deeper kind of physical, heartfelt, emotional level that that words and understanding don't do. And so we are beginning to understand what are the conditions that are supportive. Now, being... so that's one thing, this the conditioning. The second thing I want to talk about, and then I'll bring these two together, is that you also see in young children that a lot of what childhood is about is learning new skills. That they don't know how to crawl, and then they develop the skills for crawling. They don't know how to walk, then they develop the skills for walking, maybe with a lot of falling as part of it. They don't know how the skills of eating, and then they develop the skills for how to eat. And those skills sometimes develop, you know, greater and greater detail as they get older. And people who grew up with spoons eventually get forks, eventually get forks and knives. Maybe even they're introduced to chopsticks. And they develop all these physical dexterity of how to eat. And it's a skill that gets developed. And by the time we're an adult, we're not thinking about that as a skill. It's just kind of an obvious thing that we know how to do. But you watch little kids and you see they're learning how to do this. We learn language. We learn to ride a bicycle. We learn learn to put on our clothes for ourselves. And we learn all these different things. We're learning these skills. And these skills that we learn, we continue right up until we die. We're still learning skills and how to be in this world. It's a very ordinary human thing to... through repetition, through engagement, that we learn mental skills, physical skills, maybe emotional skills of how to do things. And so part of Buddhist meditation practice that has to do with time is that we are developing skills. And developing the skills of concentration, the skills of mindfulness, developing a whole bunch of skills about knowing what to bring mindfulness to and what to include. We learn after a while that we should be mindful of the fact that we're drifting off in thought a lot. Or we need to be mindful of our attitude as we meditate. I know people can meditate without realizing that there's a anger or a as part of their mindfulness. They're upset with something and there's an expectation that, you know, that some wonderful thing is going to happen, or there's some subtle thought that, you know, this I can't really do this. This is too difficult. Or there's a greed or a desire that's pushing, wanting some wonderful experience. So all these attitudes there, to learning the skill of recognizing the subtle attitudes that are somehow, sometimes even tripping us up as we meditate, or which are having an undue influence on how we meditate. And part of the skill is then to learn about conditions, to learn that it's our job to put in place the proper conditions that nourish us, that support us, that allow for the growth and well-being of who we are. Meditation is one of those. If you spent your time just watching movies on Netflix or something, and if you only spent your time chasing after making lots of money, or only spent time chasing after anything at all, you can name it, and you're preoccupied, busy, involved, then that's a conditioning factor. But if you spend time having a Sabbath, having time just to be quiet and still and content with your life as it is, creates a very different conditioning. If you feel like you always want more, then you're conditioning, you're influencing predisposing yourself that you're always not enough. There's always more to be had. And no matter then what you get, there's always more. If you're conditioning yourself to be content, then you're more likely to be content, you know, or to recognize that things are content. You don't need more and more and more. And this conditioning is not brainwashing. It's just taking the good qualities that we have and developing a skill to connect with them more often and remind ourselves more often and to cultivate the things that bring those about and bring them forth. Because we have the potential of feeding ourselves good influences. So classically, the Buddha said it's useful to spend time with good spiritual friends, to spend time with people that represent values, represent qualities of being that you want to be influenced by, that you want those to be conditioning factors for yourself. If you spend time only with angry people, only with hostile people, then maybe that's what gets kind of encouraged and returned back. So to take care of what comes in, it influences us. And the more we're in the present moment, the more we can be the custodian, the caretaker of that. And we can make the choices, both the choices about, you know, to do something as simple as, you know, there's two freeways here on the peninsula. There's 101 and there's 280. And sometimes it's been more or less the same which one I take, maybe a little bit longer on 280. And I see that driving down 280, which goes through the sometimes beautiful hillsides and sometime of year, these, you know, forests and the mountains on the side. And 101 goes down through the airport and city, urban areas in a way that's not so inspiring, parts of it. And so just to go down 280, I just feel better. I just feel more refreshed and relaxed at the end. But even if I go down 101, where it's maybe a lot of more traffic and busyness and smog and stuff, then what conditions do I want to support to develop inside of me? It isn't just a moral obligation to be patient or be a driver that's generous to the other drivers. But what do I want to develop in myself? Maybe I want to develop, I don't want to develop being in a hurry and being impatient and zigzagging out of the traffic to get someplace where I need to go as quickly as I can. Maybe what I want to develop is driving in a way where I'm driving safe and content, as if I have lots of time. And this idea that giving ourselves time and driving in a content way rather than in a discontented way and pressure, in the long game of life, those begin creating conditions that allow something deeper to unfold and develop within us. So these two things are a very important part of Buddhist practice in general, that Buddhist practice has a lot to do with putting conditions in place and has a lot to do with developing the skills to do so. Some of these conditioning factors are things like kindness. So we develop the skill of being kind. Some of it has to do with letting go. We develop the skill of letting go. Some of it has to do with, you know, being generous. And so we cultivate the capacity for generous, become skillful at learning the art of generosity and how to give wisely. There's a variety of different things we're kind of developing. The skill at being ethical conduct, the skill of wise speech. Speech which we feel nourished by it. When we finish speaking it, we feel like we've benefited from it rather than later we feel, oh, I'm so sorry I spoke that way. I was so just mostly complaining the whole time we were together and I feel a bit drained and maybe you do too. So these are all called skills that we develop. We develop beneficial skills. So it's not only a matter of showing up and being mindful in the present moment and developing present moment awareness and then trusting that all the goodness we have will come and take care of things. It's a little bit magical thinking. We develop mindfulness of the present moment, and then we see more choice. We live a more considered life. We're more wise about things. Some people put a tremendous emphasis on religious experiences. They're looking to have a great aha moment. They've heard in Buddhism there's enlightenment, and I want to get that experience of enlightenment, and then everything will be okay forever after. Or I want to have this wonderful religious experience that then I can go around and tell my friends, it's so great what happened to me. I went on retreat and this great experience happened and it was so profound and I'm so glad I had this profound experience. Wonderful experiences that can have and can arise in practice, and I don't want to diminish their importance, but to overemphasize them at the expense of the ordinary day-to-day cultivating skills, cultivating the right conditions, the long game. And some of this conditioning bears fruit in far into the future. It's possible that as we develop generosity or contentment or capacity to be equanimous, a capacity to be with pain and not to be reactive and afraid or hostile or contracted, it's a skill. A skillfulness of being with pain. It's one of the things I started learning in my early years of Buddhist practice when I was living at Zen Center. In a variety of different ways, I got the message that, Gil, it'd be good if I understood how to be present for pain without the self-pity, the reactivity, the anger. And I would look for situations where I was feeling a lot of pain, but it was safe to do so. And then I would explore it and be with it and develop a skill of being present in an equanimous way, open way, without being troubled by the pain, but being wise by it. I mean, it was simple things, like sometimes we were carrying really heavy objects. I was working on the Zen Center farm, and we had to carry farm implements. And so, allowing myself to feel the pain in doing the work without up to a limit, hopefully the healthy limit, but working with that edge, learning about myself, developing that skill. And then later in life, I had accidents or had things happen to me where I was in a lot of pain, not because I wanted to be, because it was an accident. And then I had the skill of knowing how to practice with pain. And that was really useful. To learn how to let go, and not because letting go is a moral obligation. It's just you can live a much better, happier life when you let go. That becomes obvious as people get older. I've now come, it seems like I've come into that stage of age, maybe old age, maybe, where with my friends sometimes we go through, we have a litany. And I think of a litany as, kind of a sacred repetition of a chant or something or a piece of something. Anyway, the litany of different physical ailments, how our bodies are changing and shifting as we get older, and to learn how to let go of all the physical changes, that let go of how things were and then embrace what's happening now, and finding some joy in it. Okay, well that goes now too. This too. That's a skill we develop. If you've never let go of anything your whole life, and then something happens in old age where you no longer have an ability, you can get bitter at the absence of that ability. But if you learn to let go, and learn that not only letting go, but letting go into something great, you've conditioned yourself, you've cultivated and developed a sense of peace and tranquility and love and goodness here. That letting go is not just letting go into absence or a deprived state, but letting go is letting go into this goodness that's been developed, this goodness that's been allowed to grow and all that. So then, so we have the skill of letting go comes together with how we've been conditioned, how we've allowed ourselves to be conditioned and grow, is part of the long game of meditation practice. So the long game, so conditioning. What are the conditions you want to have in place? One of the interesting things about Buddhist practice and the teachings of the Buddha, he didn't put a lot of emphasis on causality. Like we are responsible to cause things, cause our meditation practice to develop a certain way. But rather, we're responsible for putting the conditions in that allows these for growth. So there's kind of both a removal of responsibility and an addition of responsibility. We're not responsible for what actually happens, but we are responsible for putting the conditions, the best conditions in place, so that something good can happen. So there's a kind of releasing of obligation, or releasing of certain kind of self-centered effort to make something happen. It's more like grace. It's more like we receive all this goodness. We make room for it and allow it to grow and happen. And that's one part of the conditions we offer, is getting out of the way and allow the goodness to evolve and develop. But we put in the conditions that allow the best conditions for that so that the best can grow out of us. And so what are those conditions? So part of a Buddhist spiritual life is reflecting and thinking about what conditions can you realistically put into place that supports that long game, that supports that influence you want to have and the conditioning you want to develop. And what skills do you want to develop? Meditation is a skill, and it's done by repetition over and over and over again. When Fu Schrader, who taught here recently, I listened to her recently, when she was abbess of the San Francisco Zen Center, she sometimes would watch new students come in to meditate, to be new students there, and how awkward they were in their physical body sitting in meditation posture, and how they had to move and fidget throughout the meditation session. And then she'd watch slowly over the weeks and the months, their bodies would adjust and they would find a way to sit, and eventually they would sit in a very good, balanced, settled Zen posture. They develop a skill slowly over time to cultivate that, you know, settled place. So there's so many ways. Some of these skills we develop are done by repetition over and over and over again. I'll give you an analogy I've done before I love. It has to do with the old-fashioned, people don't have them anymore, I think, telephone books that work. Some of them are really fat, and they have very, very thin paper. And you take a bunch of them and stack them up on the floor, and then if you use them as a prop for a yoga posture, yoga asana, and one was the triangle post, and if you give a triangle pose and one arm is supposed to reach all the way down to the floor, but it can't get there, you have your arm reach down to the top of the telephone books. And then every day you tear off one page of the books. So each day it's almost inconsequential, the difference. But slowly, in a way it's imperceptible to you, slowly, you're able to bring your hand closer and closer and closer to the floor until finally you can do the triangle pose, touching the floor. So the gradual growth, the patient growth, the patient developing of skills, the patient development of these inner qualities and that support us and influence us, that are mutually supportive for us and the world around us. Kindness, love, generosity, truthfulness, wise speech, equanimity, compassion, letting go, relinquishment, seeing clearly, stopping and looking, mindfulness itself. So all this can get lend itself to the idea that you have to be busy. There's a lot of doing, but the idea of being busy and a lot of and doing, that is not really a good condition to have. That's not a really good influence in this process, and it's not necessarily one of the better skills we want to develop, skills of being busy. So there's a as we pay attention to all this, there's a self-correcting movement where we start recognizing what is it, how do we do things, how do we engage in Buddhist practice and all the elements of it so that it has a good influence on us, so that we're developing good skills in the process. And so this is where we come closer and closer to the present moment also, rather than thinking of the long game, that we want to discover the goodness of what we do in the moment that we do it as well. There has to be a good feeling that, oh, this is nourishing, this is supportive, this is not stressful. And so being really busy doing too much, if you really feel and are present for that experience, you can feel, oh, this doesn't work. So developing skills and putting together conditions. And to doing those things skillfully and in a way that provides conditions of ease and relaxation and enjoyment of this life that this precious life that we have. And appreciating this, our role in putting the conditions in place and developing skills can give a life a tremendous sense of purpose and value, and then it's not such a mystery how spiritual change happens. In fact, one of the signs of maturity in Buddhist practice is a real understanding of how to work with the world of conditioning and the world of skill building, and to have engaged in that for a long time, and slowly something develops and evolves over time. So the benefits that are immediate and the benefits that come through time. And I encourage you from time to time to really consider the long game. And if you do so, then you'll be ready for old age, sickness, and death. And these won't be so frightening or difficult because you've put the conditions in place and you develop the skills that will support you even through sickness, old age, and death itself. So thank you. And so one announcement. So I'm starting a retreat this afternoon, a two-week retreat. So the next two Sundays I won't be here, but I've invited two wonderful teachers to come teach. And these are both teachers who have just graduated from their teacher training, so they're relatively new teachers, though they've had a fair amount of experience already teaching, and they're quite marvelous. I just delight in both of them. So next week it's Devin Berry, and the week after that is Tara Moulay, who's been here for us teaching before. So I think you'll enjoy them quite a bit, and hearing a different voice and slightly different mindfulness teaching you'll appreciate it a lot. And then I'll be back in a few weeks, or I'll see some of you in the weekday morning meditations we do. Thank you.